Isn't today great? Today is such a great day. Everything is so great.
We're going to have a lot of fun. We got some wonderful people for you.
All you mommies and daddies out there who complain to the radio station, I got something to say to you.
And the first thing you've got to do is say the call letters properly. Okay?
It's an incredible metamorphosis of love and emotion and sensitivity and tenderness and fun and joy and happiness.
Did you know that this show represents health and hope?
It is a great day. Claim your cause and move on it. Welcome aboard the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. How are ya? We're going to take on that crazy cultural cacophony in the week that almost was, including, the fallout from the so-called blue wave and the White House's hyperbolic reaction, shall we say. And we'll talk about how to keep our momentum going. Good thing we have an activist and author in the house, Eric Dawson, who might give us some primers on that, especially for young folks. That's all coming up. Inspiration to action, challenge, success stories, because as you know, creativity fuels us in oh so many ways, personally, professionally, and certainly to give us the energy to take the impetus and run with it in our social and political causes. Music as time permits, and you in the mix. Are you listening live? It is Friday, November 9th, 12 noon out west, 2 p.m. Central, 3 o'clock here in the east. Number in motion, 347-857-4505. Twitter feed is 24/7, so live or on podcast, dive in when it works for you at AB Rights. And if you are listening live, the entire social media platforms are available, including our Facebook page and the PopNet chat box. All being helmed by our tenacious, talented TCS crew, Trudy and Aurora in the booth, ML at headquarters. Show today brought to you in part by Panera. It's the way food should be, now delivered. By Old Navy, it's time to fall in for great styles and fashions at Old Navy. And, of course, by our friends at PopNet. Arts, culture, conversation on air online 24/7, featuring select editions of the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show and those robust, occasionally raucous roundtables. Let's get started by meeting Eric Dawson. He is the founder of Peace First, a nonprofit organization he started over 25 years ago as a young person to motivate and energize and train other young people to become activists. And he's put together a primer, a new handbook called Putting Peace First, Seven Commitments to Change the World. Fabulous and timely indeed. Eric, congratulations on all your great work that you're doing for so many years, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be on your show.
Great to have you here. You know, we should say we're also in the wake of this horrible tragedy that just happened yesterday in Thousand Oaks, California, another mass shooting. I believe they said it was the 307th such shooting in this year, and they classify those shootings as four more people being injured and or killed, and 11 days in between the Squirrel Hill Synagogue massacre and where 11 or 12 people were killed there, and another 13 people if you count the shooter in this one. I mean, it's just so many tragedies. But I bring that up to mention, I mean, of course, it's horrible what happened, but also the fact that there's been so much activism on the level from young people in the wake of the Parkland tragedy, where those kids got together and what they did, mobilizing to actually get the Republican governor, who may become the new Republican senator from Florida, Rick Scott, certainly someone who was aligned with the NRA, but he saw the magnitude of that tragedy and actually spearheaded and signed legislation to increase the age of buying firearms to 21, and they outlawed bump stocks, I believe. And after this, those kids went on and they've been mobilizing voter registration since then. So a lot of the things that you put forth in your primer and in all your work really applies to these kids. So I don't know if you've been involved with them or not, but I just thought I'd throw that out there as sort of a starting point. What's your take on this? Is there a new surgence of, I mean, you've been doing this for so long. We should say you started this in your own school, your own high school years ago, because of the way they were handling kids with disabilities. Talk a little bit about how you got involved and how you spearheaded this whole idea of kids getting involved at a young age.
That's right. You know, I joke that I've had the same job for 25 years since I was 18. So really outside of Burger King, this has been my only gainful employment, which is either deep personal commitment or lack of professional ambition. But I did, I started super young. You know, I was angry as a kid, as a lot of young people are. And, you know, frankly, a lot of the adults are. I thought the world was unfair. I thought the adults around me, good intention as they were not doing the things I thought adults did, which was fix things and take care of people and love me. And began organizing my high school as a 14-year-old around disability awareness. This was the start of the inclusion movement when kids with disabilities were being mainstream for the first time and basically having the crap beat out of them, and began organizing in my school and then, of course, my entire district. And for me, it was the first time I got to feel powerful in a way that was really about transformation. And what I discovered as I got a scholarship to go to college is that this experience is fairly unique. Young people sit at the bottom of the privilege pyramid. I don't care what kind of indicators you're looking at, whether it's access to education or healthcare or climate change. Young people bear the brunt of the decisions that adults make on their behalf, and yet we rarely invite them to be part of the solution, right? Our narratives are young people are victims, we have to protect, traitors we need to punish, or they're the future, right? We go into schools and onto radio shows, and we tell young people, y'all are going to be great leaders, artists, activists someday, right? Some mythical time in the future. But in fact, if you look at movements, as we have over the past 120 years, from the workers' rights movement to the Arab Spring, they've always been powered by young people, right? Dr. King really got his start leading the national movement. He was 26, right? He was assassinated at 39. Like young people, because they are close to the problems, they're close to the solutions.
Yes, the urgency of now. I think that is wasn't that a Dr. King expression?
Exactly.
Get in there and do it now. And it's amazing though. How did you get started? You just started with your friends. You started when you were in school, and you said, "I don't like the way these kids are being treated." How did you start it?
The question I'm most asked on panels and whatnot, if I had to do it all over again, like if I went back in time, what would I do differently? And I never say this, but my honest answer is I wouldn't do it, right? Because I supposedly know better now. And ignorance is this wonderful enabler of the possible, right? I just didn't know any better that I wasn't supposed to get started. It was exactly as you described. Like I started talking to other young people and talking about what the problem was. And, so much of the way that we tell our history is linear, right? This happened and this happened and this happened. But social change is messy. It's complicated. You try something out, there's a step back. And that was my experience, which was trying to figure out how we change our school culture, and not because the principal says we're a zero-tolerance school, but students to students deciding we were going to be different. And that's what was powerful about it.
Right. The paradigm shift doesn't shift until everybody gets on board, or enough people get on board, I should say, and start to make their own changes and perceive it differently and want to do it. But it's a pretty audacious time to kids do it though now. And what you just said I think is so great, because you're right. When you think about when you start things, and I always think that too as being a writer or anything creative, people said, do you regret doing it? I said, yeah, but I was young and dumb. So you start it, you think it's going to be fun, you don't know, and as you go, you don't know how hard it's going to be. So you start taking the various steps, and you need that youthful optimism and ignorance in some ways to try to, as you said, all these things get started because people don't know better, and they have the energy to keep going and not to be despondent. The only thing is to worry about, like you said, the setbacks. There are going to be some setbacks. So how do you – it's interesting. I love the way you call these people peacemakers too, which is it's a refreshing way to look at it versus community activists.
Right.
Well, how did you come to the term peacemaker? I love it though, because it's great. Yeah.
Right. It's both forward looking and like super retrograde. I came out of the violence prevention movement. I was involved in early youth organizing around gun violence and the sort of skyrocketing murder rates in the early 90s. And what I found so disturbing about the language about violence prevention, and I grew up with Nancy Reagan telling me not to use drugs. Like it was all about like what not to do or who not to be. It was so intensely negative. And as you know, human beings and young people in particular are inherently creative, right? They want to make, they want to design, they want to build. And so this idea about being a peacemaker, like not a peacekeeper or peace, but like making and creating peace, to build something that felt muscular while also being idealistic was exciting to me. And to be super honest, what worries me and worried me at the time about what we invite young people to do, we have this youth service industrial complex, right? Which is where we tell young people to do their 50 service hours. It's transactional. You know, how many cookies did you bake? How many hours did you volunteer? How much money did you raise, right? Those are outputs. Like, how do we help young people be compassionate, right? Right, to cross lines of difference? How do we help them be brave, right? To take risks, to stretch themselves? And how do we understand that real social change, real social justice happens through networks? It's not individuals, right? It's two of us in a conversation deciding we're going to make the world a better place.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, you've been doing this for so many years now. Have things changed? I mean, have the kids changed? Have the ideals changed? How you do it changed? I mean, what do you take on that?
So it's yes and no. So, you know, I do work with young people in 126 countries, every state. And, you know, there's something common to young people all over the globe. Their curiosity, their entrepreneurship, their commitment to justice, their sense of fairness. Like even little kids, like watching them play tag, like no tag backs is like this important statement about justice, right? Like young people are moral creatures at a very young age that I think we forget. And there is something about this generation coming up that feels significantly more engaged, significantly more tuned in. And the tools they have for collaboration is amazing, right? When I started back in 1992 and we went into schools here in Boston to teach young people the skills of peacemaking, we carried binders with us. 78% of teenagers have smartphones. Like, they've got the binders at their fingertips, the access to information, the ability to collaborate and connect. And this group of young people coming up are incredibly intersectional. They are thinking and building connections. Like, what I loved about the Parkland students and their work is one of the first things they did is they reached out to young people in Chicago. And we're like, look, we may have had this horrible thing happen in our high school. There are young people in our country for whom that's their everyday experience. And we're going to cede the stage to them, right? We're going to do this together. It's incredibly powerful to watch.
Yeah, and it's interesting because a lot of adults were like shocked that these kids could pull it off, because everybody was talking about how this is a generation that's just glued to the phones, glued to the screens, have no engagement, but they're using those tools in a way that, and they're very articulate and very passionate about what they're doing and really efficient. I mean, they did it in a record amount. I mean, yes, there's going to be some setbacks because now we're still back to where we were. There's still all these violent episodes. I mean, it's a bigger problem than one group of kids doing anything, but they did get a law change in a very red state. So that's something. It's not nothing in a very short amount of time.
You're exactly right. And I think about, you know, my own experience. I have a daughter who's 16, and the other day I asked her if she wanted to call one of her friends, and, you know, she lovingly rolled her eyes at me and said, "Daddy, we don't call our friends, we text our friends." And, you know, I remember, like, 30 years ago sitting on my couch and my mom saying, "Oh, sweetie, why don't you go out and play with your friends?" I'm like, "Mom, we don't go out and play with our friends. We talk to them on the phone." Right. So
yeah,
each generation
yeah.
creates their own tools. And then the generation yeah. before rolls its eyes and complains about it. But young people are doing very powerful things using technology as their engine. And I'm incredibly hopeful.
Yeah, they're very engaged, which is me too, I think, because of that. I mean, there's so many issues and so many problems, and there will be setbacks along the way. How do you help them with that, the idea that you can't get it all done in one fell swoop because the idealism and the impatience of youth is inherent? Do you help them temper that or realize, you know, take small bites, so to speak, or small steps, and each one counts?
Well, like many things, I think the problems often lie in the roots of adult behavior. And I think adults are very uncomfortable with young people's failure. I remember my son walking for the first time, and the first thing he did, he fell flat on his face. And, you know, like, I just wanted to, like, swoop him up and cover him in duct tape and bubble wrap and be like, "I'm just going to carry you for the next 30 years. Like, adults are very worried about
young
people's failure. To get over that, because it's really our own hearts that we're protecting. And so part of it is normalizing failure. Like, we're not all getting A's. We're not all getting trophies. Like, this is part of what it means to grow and to learn and to create. And then the message for young people is this is a journey. And really in the book, what I talk about, you know, it's a manifesto. So it's built around a set of seven commitments. Like, it's about who you are, not just what you do. And this is a journey. I mean, my whole seventh chapter is about failure. And I tell the story of Mary Pat Hector, this incredible young organizer who, as a 15-year-old outside of Atlanta, talked about being to more funerals and graduations because of gun violence. And her insight, this idea that she had, was to use shock ads, the same thing we use to get people to not smoke or not to use drugs, to use these same modes of communication to get young people not to pick up a gun and fire at someone else. It's a brilliant idea, and she got amazing images of violence, and it was multicultural and multi-class, like really trying to draw the circle bigger and bigger. And everyone told her it was a bad idea. Everybody. She went to 50 agencies to help her. Every agency said no. Like again and again, she was told this isn't going to work. And finally, we invested about $50,000 in her project to get it off the ground. And the summer that she did it, her billboards were in one police district. And the police surveyed the summer activities, and her community where she put these billboards up was the only community where violence went down, right? It's like a clear sign that her work was effective. And still no one would fund it. They took them down. They put up billboards of, you know, pawn shops and auto repairs. And what I find so amazing about Mary Pat is she kept at it. She kept trying different things. And in fact, not this election, but the one before, she was the youngest person ever to run for public office in the state of Georgia. And her opponent actually tried to get her kicked off the ballot. And she won a court case saying that actually, you know, young people have the right to run for office just as anyone else does.
How old was she when she ran?
18.
18. Oh, okay. So you're, you know, as long as you're 18, because that's when you can vote. So why would they even have a way to get rid of her?
It's amazing.
Challenge
the way people
try to
stop young people. Yeah.
That's true. But resilience, you're teaching resilience and persistence. And I think that's, I mean, you said failure is the way, you know, people always say it's a cliche, you learn more from your failures than your successes, but it's kind of true, because you do have to pick yourself up and negotiate it and navigate it and also realize, yeah, I'm still here. So it's not the end of the world, but we, you know, you still have to, you know, not to be depressed and despondent about it, I guess, and to, you know, see some small success. And she obviously did, because she said she saw some of the crime go down, even though nobody else was picking it, they weren't funding it or they weren't putting the billboards back. She did see some positive results, so she could take that with her. I will say, as Georgia, of course, they're still working on whether or not they're going to have a recount, I guess, in the governor's race. But one big piece of happy news down there was that Lucy McBath, who lost her son to a senseless crime, he was playing his music too loud in a parking lot, I believe in Florida, actually, and he was killed. She became a gun control advocate since, and she wound up winning the congressional seat in Georgia that was once held by Newt Gingrich. So there you go. So some, you know, positive results.
Yeah.
And she
won as a darkness. Woman of color in a predominantly white district.
Yeah.
Like,
it's amazing.
It could be so despondent when we look at the world as a whole. And then when you dig deeper, you see these amazing, kind, generous, fierce, loving acts that people are committing to. And we remember that that's what changes the world, right? The civil rights movement wasn't Dr. King and Selma. It was hundreds of thousands of people, mostly young people and women, sitting in church pews and around kitchen counters, deciding they were going to be different. It is those individual, delicate, powerful, collaborative acts that move the arc of history toward justice.
It's the grassroots. Well, what about older people? I mean, we can all learn from this. It's not just for kids. I know that you mostly work with young people, and the primer is kind of geared to young people, but we can all take something from it, because, you know, it's about being connected. It's about empowering young people, but also you see some of these middle-aged, particularly women, but all men and women, who are disaffected with what's going on in the government, who have become involved in the indivisible movement, have become political for the first time in their entire lives, and those kinds of things. So are there things that you have in this primer that we can all take from it?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, these are inspiring stories of young people, and they're daily things to do to put these practices into your daily life that work for everyone. You know, it's really interesting. We're talking about the students in Parkland, and we've been supporting a number of them and other young people who are excited and engaged and enraged and want to make a difference. And I was talking to a group of them, because there's been this narrative that's been developing, which at first I really love, but have since understood to be problematic, which is that, you know, us in an older generation, we've messed everything up. we got to get out of the way because young people have the amp. And interesting talking to young people whose response to that is no, y'all messed this up. You need to stick around and help us fix it, that we need to do this together. You know, the sense that our liberation is bound up. And I think that is what's so powerful in every one of these stories. And I've interviewed, you know, tens of thousands of young people. They all talk about an adult who is an ally. You know, sometimes it meant that it got out of their way. Sometimes it meant that they helped. But they all talk about an adult who took them seriously. So we all have a role to play, big or small, in supporting a more just world and supporting young people's leadership in that work.
Yeah, and there's no small role, really. You do what you can do, and sometimes people think, well, what can I do as one person? But as you said, there's always something you can do, and it starts with one inspiration. It starts with one act of kindness. It starts with connecting with other people and talking about the ideas and putting some action into play and paying it forward. All of those things do matter and do count, and especially now we need to sort of, you know, turn the tide away from the negativity. There is so much negative out there, of course, and anger and vitriol, but as we say, does start from the top, but it really doesn't have to start from the top because it's not going to in this case where we're at right now politically. We're going to have to start from the bottom up and in and out and just work with each other and try to tone down the rhetoric a little bit. I think that helps. I mean, there's so much anger on both sides and the sense of it's unfair, unfairness, right or wrong. People have their own perceptions and they're all entitled to it, I think, and just being more generous in our hearts and listening to the other side. I'm trying to do that all the time. And sometimes it's like swimming in a puddle, though, because they don't really have anything to back up the facts on the other end of it. But that's okay. You know, it's okay. You're entitled to it, you know. But don't talk at people. I guess that's part of it, too, is you listen more than you and don't preach and expect it to change just by talking. I think you need to mobilize and try to engage in ways that mean something to the other party, too. And young people sometimes are better at that than the older folks. But it's interesting that you're doing this work for so long. God bless you, because it's important work. And I know you said it's your only job, but it's probably a very gratifying one, I'm assuming, if you've been sticking with it for 25-plus years.
You know, Frederick Douglass had this piece where he talked about in the struggle for justice, the only reward is to be in the struggle. And I have to say, you know, I'm incredibly hopeful about the world. You know, so if your listeners pick nothing else up from this conversation, know that there are 1.6 billion young people on this planet who are curious, who are committed, who are working for justice, who are working with compassion, and they're just waiting to be loved and supported on that journey.
All right, we're ready to do it. We're ready to help. That's every way we can. Fascinating work you're doing. Interesting book called Putting Peace First: Seven Commitments to Change the World. Eric Dawson. Folks can find it at the usual places. I'm guessing Amazon. Do you have a website you want to promote or no?
Absolutely, peacefirst.org. So not only can you get the book there, but it's a digital platform for 13 to 25 year olds who want to change the world. So we help young people create projects, we provide funding, and we provide connectivity. And so, if any folks want to just get inspired and listen to stories and watch what young people are doing, it's a great place to spend an afternoon.
PeaceFirst.org. We'll post it on our social media platforms. Thank you so much, Eric. I appreciate all the work you're doing. Good luck to you, and please come back and see us again.
Thank you. Take care.
Take care. That's Eric Dawson. We'll put all his info for you on the social media platform, along with the podcast. Stick around. It is the Amy Beth Arkin Show.
Small peace and love is just for the children of the new generation.
Come on.
Yeah, that peace train is getting nearer. Maniacs, 10,000 strong on the Amy Beth Arkley Show, putting their signature on the Cat Stevens classic. And Nick Lowe, what's so funny about Peace, Love, and Understanding, having a way with his own song. Yeah, he penned it. Elvis Costello had the big punk hit, and so many folks have done it. But he does a pretty good job of it, too. We honor the peacemakers, the young people who are making so many great changes in the world, and Eric Dawson, who started the group Peace First over 25 years ago and has been helping young people mobilize and commit to projects of value ever since. Interesting primaries put together, too, called Putting Peace First, Seven Commitments to Change the World. Some really inspiring stories. We will post the details to his website for the group as well as the podcast when it becomes available. As you know, they're all archived as such. But important work, and we're all part of it. You don't have to be a young person to get involved, as we know. Especially a lot of women who are just fed up with even Republican women. I'm amazed at so many people who are just said, I had enough of this, and they are actually not just voting Democrat, but getting out and ringing doorbells and working hard, and in some cases becoming candidates themselves. As we saw this so-called blue wave. Was it a wave? Was it a trickle? We could argue about it. We've been arguing all week about it on PopNet and other places, but I think it was enough of a wave, because I think when all is said and done, we're going to get at least a 31 to 35 seat uptick in the House. Senate looks like it's going to remain the same, but actually the Republicans may gain a couple of seats, but not quite as many as they might have thought, since we lost a couple. We lost North Dakota, we lost Indiana, Tennessee was always lost. The Democrat couldn't win. But it was a flip. Arizona's still up for grabs. They held on to Montana despite President Trump's desperation to get a hold of John Tester's scalp there. And, Dean Heller, who clung to Trump, was booted. Jackie Rosen will take that spot, so we got a gain there. Poor Heidi Heitkamp fell in North Dakota. And we're not sure about Arizona. Sinema is up now. We'll see. McSally, of course, also clung to Trump after she didn't cling to Trump at the beginning, but did in the final stretch, and also lied and lied and lied about her own voting record when it comes to the Affordable Care Act. Again, people should be happy that the Democrats took back the House, because now the Republicans have abandoned their attempts to totally decimate the Affordable Care Act. Mitch McConnell has abandoned the idea of repealing, and of course they never had an idea of replacing it. So people who I've spoken with who are Trumpians for no good reason other than we wanted a change, but we liked the stuff that Obama did, those people, and you know who you are, if you're listening, you're happy. You should be happy that they're saving your Medicare, your Medicaid, your Social Security, because that's what they're going to try to come after next, and we'll see what happens in the Senate. But we've still got some question marks. Florida, of course, is still up for grabs. It looks like there'll be another, oh, dear, here we go with the swinging chads. Remember, maybe Catherine Harris will come out of retirement and start the recount going back from 2000. We'll see. Recounts probably both in the Senate race and the gubernatorial race down there. At first, Gillum conceded, and I never quite understood why he was conceding when it looked like his margin of, the margin of victory for DeSantis appeared to be smaller than the margin of victory was looking like for Scott in the Senate race. Now, they still, I think, have the edge on the Republicans, but now the Republicans are, to me, it's crazy, because, look, you should have to count every single vote to the best of the ability, and unfortunately, I always say, make it too big to rig. If the turnout is big enough and the difference is big enough, then it's not a problem, because not every single vote gets counted. We learned that from 2000. But we're so polarized, it's pretty much a 50-50 split in a lot of places. That's just the way it is, so they have to get better at counting these votes. But they all have to get counted. The idea that we can't count them, and Trump and company and Rubio are making these, specious arguments that somehow there's some kind of voter fraud going on in Broward County and other places. I mean, it makes no sense, when in fact sometimes we know the Republicans try to suppress the vote. They go about purging these lists, these rosters in Georgia. Of course, that's also up for grabs in the gubernatorial end. There wasn't a Senate race there, but as we said, we got some pickups in the House in Georgia, which was pretty amazing. I don't know. Kemp still looks like he has the advantage. Will there be a runoff in Georgia if they don't get 50%? There's a runoff. He's still slightly above 50%, but they do have to count all the votes, and they're, disgusted with the fact that they have to do it. And then you have all these stories coming out, first of all, that he purged a lot of the roles as Secretary of State, did not recuse himself from this role, which is ridiculous. And then the idea that, who knows if it's true, but anecdotal evidence supports that they jammed up or hid some voting machines in some counties. We certainly know they changed the times and closed up some polling places. It shouldn't be that way. I mean, I voted in suburban New York in and out in under 10 minutes. I have always voted that way. I lived in a different town. I was wondering, will it be the same? It's the same. I know New York City had some problems because there are more people, I guess, but the polling places, the way they do it here, you're in and out, it's not a problem. That's the way it should always be. Now, you have to wait in line maybe for 10 minutes, not for an hour, 2 hours, 5 hours, around the block, 6 hours, people are waiting. It shouldn't be that way. There should be a uniform way to do it, and the uniform way to do it, mail-in ballots all across. A lot of states, New York is not one of them, I hope they're going to change that, have early voting where you can vote by mail earlier, or they have rolling voting where they have polling places that are open for a couple of weeks in advance. Because what do you have? Like, we had a horrible weather day. It was pouring rain. It wasn't a big storm like, you know, ice and snow, you couldn't get out, but it was nasty, and I'm sure it suppressed some people. So basically, if you had mail-in voting all the way around, you would get a bigger turnout. I think Oregon has it. My sister in New Jersey, they now have, you have to opt out if you don't want to be part of it, but who would want to opt out of that? Wouldn't that be easier? I just think you'll get more people to do it. And it should be easier, not harder to vote. That's one thing, regardless of how you do it. I'm not talking about ideology. I'm not talking about party now. I'm talking about the right to vote. That is the most sacred thing we have. And in fact, we should see it not just as a right, but an obligation, so that people will turn out in bigger numbers and should do it. And we see that. This was a very heavily a big turnout for a midterm year. I think it was slightly less than the turnout in 2016, which was a low turnout year for a presidential race, and we see how that helped us, right? You got to turn out. You got to vote. You got to speak up. You got to get involved. Twitter feed, AB Wright, phone line 347-857-4505. I know I'm babbling on too much. Let's get a couple of folks here. Andy on Twitter says, "Dear Trumpsters, the real Donald Trump really thinks you're stupid. Are you stupid? Do you remember his last voter fraud claim? Those so-called 3 million California votes by illegals. He formed a commission and months later shut it down because there was no evidence. Now the new BS is about Florida. Don't let him fool you." Yeah, he'll try, though. He will. Oh, man, he's off the rails. That press conference yesterday was crazy, and crazier today also in front of the helicopter. I guess he feels cornered. And when you feel cornered and you feel like the political poachers are coming after you, God knows what he'll do. Think about it. Reach out. It is the Amy Beth Darkley Show.
Someone told me you got to be free. Someone told me to stand in the rear. Keep on searching for kings in the street. Keep on crying for something that's clear. You are one more posse to pass in the night. One more con to conceal. One more tiger to paint on the stripe.
Right or left, who didn't quite make the cut on election day, maybe they want a career change. I'm not running anymore. But don't be so short, because once it's in their bloodstream, somehow they want back in. And America, too, political poachers, they're out there trying to poach success, power, etc. And that goes for all politicians, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. But Trump, boy, did he seem off the rails at the press conference yesterday and today in front of the helicopter. He was fielding questions and red-faced, sweaty, pacing like a caged animal trying to change the subject from the election. And, he did, because he revoked Jim Acosta's press credentials, lambasted the press big time, lambasted other Republicans who lost, who did not, quote-unquote, in his words, embrace the endorsement. I mean, that's really childish. You talk about toddler-in-chief tantrum behavior. Wow. Off the rails, indeed. And, of course, he fired Jeff Sessions, installed a toady, Jeff Sessions' so-called chief of staff. Matthew Whitaker, who got the job in the White House because he was encouraged by a friend to go on the panel shows, which may be his undoing when it comes to this Mueller probe, which is what got Sessions tossed. Of course, he, quote-unquote, resigned with a letter that said, as of your urging or your preference, I'm resigning. So he knew it was basically getting fired. I don't know if that was smart. He should just let him fire him, because then he could collect unemployment. Never mind. But anyhow, it's kind of murky what's going to happen with this Whitaker guy. And, of course, he's very much has already declared the Mueller probe a hoax, a witch hunt, no collusion, going with the party line. They have him on various shows on CNN and radio shows, et cetera, while he was a so-called commentator. This is a guy who was a U.S. attorney in Iowa, but was under some murky, also involved in some murky businesses with some kind of a hot tub company that was declared a fraud, so he must be simpatico with Trump. But today, Trump said, I don't know this guy. I hired him because he has a good reputation, but I don't know him. Except he does know him, because supposedly he was running interference between Sessions and Trump when Trump was furious with Sessions for recusing him from the Mueller probe. It'll be intriguing if Whitaker winds up recusing himself, but I don't think he will. He says he has no intention of doing that, but ethics folks say he really should. But I thought it was very funny. I don't know if you caught this in the helicopter press conference when he said, well, why should I? Because he had an opinion. He wasn't part of the government then. Everybody has an opinion. I mean, he was on a lot of shows. If you pick somebody who's not in a show, then you have to find somebody who's living in a shell, which just is so telling about Trump, because there are a lot of lawyers who work for the Justice Department and other agencies and have other experience who don't go on the shows. He is addicted to cable TV and watches all those shows, so that's how this guy got the job, and a friend had told him, "Go on, you'll get his attention by going on the shows and singing the party line." So again, whether this guy believes it or not, who knows? I'm not impugning his judgment or his honesty or authenticity, but to actually say it's obvious that there was no collusion is also someone who is not keeping an open mind, because it's not obvious one way or the other. And I get in trouble with my progressive friends when I say that, but we don't know what Mueller has in front of him. We don't know what they can make, case they can make. Clearly there's evidence of Russian interference. Clearly there's evidence that some people in the campaign were involved with the Russians on some level. Whether it will go to the top and, Trump has deniability and all that, I don't know. We'll see. We don't know where the evidence is. But what I don't like, or what I find amusing and just ridiculous, is this whole idea of this red line, that Mueller has to be reined in. He's not allowed to go to a certain place. That's not how it works. When you have an investigation, let's take it out of this whole sphere and ping it into a regular police action. If the police have a warrant to come into your house because they suspect you of having stolen property or drugs in your house, and they stumble upon one or six dead bodies, that doesn't mean they don't start a murder investigation because they were there for another reason. So in other words, if Mueller is there to look for the Russian involvement in the campaign, but he comes up with some financial things that may connect Trump's businesses to Russia, yes, that is valid, and that can be that you can't call it. You can't have a red line. That makes no sense, and that's not the way the justice system should work, and Trump should not be above the law. My opinion, what's yours? Twitter feed, AB Wright, phone line 347-857-4505, Facebook page, PopNet, chat box open, Dom on PopNet. Yeah, I'm listening live, but I thought you were on at 5 on Fridays. Good show. Well, you normally are lately on Fridays, but we had a guest scheduled for 3, so we did it there. We have some flexibility because, of course, with the podcast situation being what it is, but I'm glad you're listening live, Dom. Thank you so very much. Raging Bull No Trump says on Twitter, that's the full title, you ever wonder why Trump gets creamed in his home state of New York? It's simple. Who knows Trump better? New York and New Jersey watched him for 40 years through his friends and business associates. The people that voted for him fell for his con. Now they feel the pain. Well, I agree with you, and I said that all along as someone who lives in New York. I don't get it. What do they see that, you know, why don't they get it? But the point is, it's out there. The information was out there before, and it's out there now. But I always say, in order for the con to work, people have to want to buy into the con. And there's still enough people who do want to buy into the con. Not everybody. Some people have realized they're wrong, but we'll see. There's still a lot of people saying that predictions for 2020 is he'll run for re-election and win. So who knows? You know, Sweetie says, be careful, Trump. Don't think for a second that you rule anything. Remember, dictators who try to follow the path of Mussolini set forth risk reaching the same destination. Trump, not my president, America first. Well, yeah, he is the president, so when people disavow him, I get it, and I disavow him too, but he is the president. And yes, he's trying to overreach big time. A lot of people think he wants to squelch the Mueller probe ASAP because the big fear now is that new indictments may be coming down, and one person in particular may be targeted, and that is Donald Trump Jr. over that whole Trump Tower meeting that everybody says nothing to see here, but Trump himself is involved in dictating it, at least in the aftermath, too. So is Jr. in trouble? Will he be up for treason charges? What will be in the indictment say if it happens? Even he's saying to friends he expects it could be happening soon. Not a good future for that. Here's a good one from Roy Zimmerman, the satirist troubadour in the Amy Beth Arcudi show.
Junior, who did you turn to? You heard the Russians had dirt to give to you. A normal human would have called the FBI. But when this guy told you to jump, all you said was, how I? Junior, we got your number.
So phony.
Junior, we got your number. You're going to the band. Junior, you'll get a cell number for T-R-E-A-S-O-N. T-R-E-A-S-O-N. I love it. Give me the dirt on Hillary. You're the ripest of the rotten tomatoes. You're the Fredo in a family of Fredos. Junior, we got your number. You're going in for dental life. Junior, you'll wear a number for T-R-E-A-S-O-N.
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 свидания.
She must belong to San Francisco. She must have lost her way. Posting a poster of Poncho and Cisco one California day. She says she believes in a Robin Hood and brotherhood and colors of green and gray. And all you can do is laugh at her. Doesn't anybody know how to pray? Arizona, take off your rainbow shade. You're acting like a teeny bopper runaway child. And scrape off the paint from the face of a little town saint.
Arizona, take off your hobo shoes. Arizona, hey, won't you go my way? I will be guide your way. I'll be the Count of Monte Cristo. You'll be the Countess May. You can believe in Robin Hood and Brotherhood and rolling the ball in the hay.
And I will be reading you an Aesop's fable. Anything to make you say.
Headed to Arizona, Forgotten 45, for Kelly via the PopNet chat box on the Amy Beth Oakley Show, still trying to sort things out, who will be the next senator in Arizona, Martha McSally or Kristen Sinema, the Democrat. Sinema has a slim lead as of now. For a while, McSally had a slim lead. We'll see what happens. They're still doing some counts, and the Republicans don't like it. Stop counting when the Republican is ahead. Don't. It's nuts, if you ask me. Really, it is. And, of course, Roy Zimmerman, I love that guy. He is a satirist, troubadour, and a song, a Junior, Treason. Could Don Trump Jr. be facing indictment? He has already told friends who are now distancing themselves and saying, hey, we're just acquaintances, bro, as a possibility of getting indicted as early as next week. The Mueller probe will be crashing in, or being squelched. I say they've had enough time. Let's get a report, drop it as soon as possible. The problem, of course, is the Democrats don't take control of the House until January. So can they squelch it in the interim? They're trying to preserve all kinds of things, and protests have been popping up as of last night, Protect Mueller, Save Mueller, all of that stuff. So it's very intriguing. I love Trump with his logic. That, of course, eludes so many people. It works for him to live in his own reality, I suppose, but it has so far. He has gone through life conning people and grifting with impunity. Things may change in January, we're hoping, when he finally has some oversight for the very first time in his life. Think about it. The guy's in his 70s, and really nobody's watched what the heck he's been doing for all these years in anything, business, etc., and he's gotten away with it. Even the tax fraud and scam seems to have gotten away with it, the whole family, for decades. We'll see if any of this stuff comes to a head at any point, but his logic about when people said, well, Whitaker, the guy that he installed as the acting AG, needs to be confirmed, Whether he does or not, I'm not sure about the rules, because if you're acting, you might not have to. But he was already confirmed, he said, as a U.S. attorney in Iowa. But Mueller was never confirmed. But that's not true, because if you're gonna say he was confirmed by the Senate for some job as U.S. attorney in Iowa, and he was, I guess, for that, Mueller has been confirmed as the FBI director on two different occasions. So, yes, he wasn't confirmed for this particular job, and you don't need to be confirmed, I guess, to be a special prosecutor. I don't know the ins and outs, but if you're, you know, it's a tit-for-tat thing. If you're going to apply that rule, that if you're confirmed under any circumstances, he already was. But, of course, he plays fast and loose with the facts, whether he knows them or not. It's whether they work for him or not. Convenience is all about the story with Donald Trump, indeed. And one of the things that was interesting, Michelle Obama has a book coming out. It drops on Tuesday officially. She's going to start doing media this weekend on ABC. They had a sit-down interview with her. Then she's on The View, other shows, et cetera, next week. And one of the things that they dropped as part of the teaser was a comment about Donald Trump and saying that she'll never forgive him for ginning up the whole birtherism business because it actually caused threats to her family, put her kids' safety at risk, et cetera. So when he was confronted with this question, he said, really? Well, she got a lot of money for that book, and you have to say controversial things. And anyway, I'll never forgive him for what he did to our country by decimating the military, which, of course, is not true. But he likes to say things, and he always has to do it. He's like a little kid, you know, with a scrunched-up face, like getting red in the face like a kid having a tantrum. It's just... on the face of it, would be funny if he were not the President of the United States, which just makes it crazy. But there you have it. Anyway, creativity fuels us. Let's take on our Inspiration to Action challenge. It's Caroline in Westchester, Pennsylvania, which she writes in is the home of QVC, the shopping network. How well I know it. And then she says, she's been listening, very complimentary thing, says, listening to the show for over 2 years, really enjoy your style, the interviews, the free-form nature of it. It reminds me of late 60s, 70s radio. Yeah, me too. Too young to remember it, but sort of do some of it. 70s, yes, I remember. And then she says, I've been doing the challenge for about a year now, diligently, and doing the journaling. It does work. I am looking at some poetry. I'm not really sure if anything professional will come of it, but I do feel more inspired, lighter, and enjoying life better. So there you go. That's part of it, right? Well, that's not just part of it. That's the whole thing in a nutshell, Caroline. It doesn't matter whether it's professional or not. It's what it gives you in your life. It reinvigorates you, reignites your spark. It's up to you to what you want to do with it. And sometimes it's not up to you. It's just what happens to come from the work. But if the work is giving you joy, then I'm happy for you, and please keep at it. Hey, Inspiration to Action Challenge, has it worked for you? I'd love to give you a shout-out. You deserve it for all the work you're putting in, but you're also spurring other folks on, whether they want to do it professionally or just personally enhance their lives. It's all about the process of embracing creativity and making creativity fuel you, feel better about your own life, and help give you energy for whatever it is you want to do in your life, personally, professionally, and political, social causes, etc. So please reach out and tell us about it. If you need a little start in the right direction, let's start a creativity coaching counseling conversation. First one is on me. Either way, reach out to the website. It's amybetharkawy.com. Easy access via the Twitter feed. Please give me 2 to 3 weeks to connect, and we'll do it. I'll give you a primer on the challenge, some other tips and tricks to get you in the right spirit. There you go. While you're up there, too, you can peruse my stories, the Eliza Gordon mysteries, some other goodies up for grabs, and you can chime in with your guest suggestions, Big Story and Forgotten 45 requests, kind of a one-stop shop. Links to the podcast there as well. So one of the cool things this week was Carole King coming out of retirement. I don't think she really retired, did she? She was always around. And she looks great. She's like 76, I think, 77. Found the fountain of youth, doing what she loves, creativity for sure. She reworked one of her songs that she wrote back in 1977 called One and put a political stamp, there I could say it, on it in terms of people getting together and feeling the power of the unity. And I think she performed it on the Today Show. But anyway, here's the new version, One, 2018, from the great, ageless Carole King. I'm Amy Beth Arkawy Show.
Whenever I find injustice being done, and I wonder, what am I gonna do? What am I gonna do? Be one. of us are one. Open your heart and let the love come shining through, and you will do what you need to do to know just where the other you is coming from. We are.
Cheryl Wheeler on the Amy Beth Arkwi Show, and that beauty from Carole King all come together as one, updated for 2018. Politically speaking, let's join together and try to eradicate this gun problem. oh my God, heart aches for those poor people who perished in the Thousand Oaks tragedy yesterday. Just saw a couple of the parents, this one man whose son, he didn't know if he was in the bar or not, but he kept trying to reach his phone. Did you see this on CNN? You could just feel his pain, and when he found out that his son had been one of those folks who was killed, it was just so palpable. And another mother whose son improbably had been at that horrible massacre in Las Vegas, and he survived that. Unfortunately, he did not survive this particular shooting. It's just awful, just awful. Something has to be done. Those Parkland kids are on the right track, one step at a time, but we have to shift the paradigm. You know, we did it with seatbelts, we did it with smoking. You don't eradicate it completely, but you certainly put it on the right path to squelching it with stricter laws. It's a whole host of things. I know it's complex, but we have to talk about it and we have to do something about it. And maybe the kids have got the right idea. Those Parkland kids got something done in very red, or so we thought, Florida, although now they're still working on that recount. So we'll see. Eric Dawson, who's working with kids for 25 years, is very encouraged. He feels optimistic that the future will be better because the kids are working hard and he's putting peace first. Peacefirst.org is his site. Go there if you want inspirational stories from young people. If you are a young person or know one, you have a kid, you're a teacher, put them in that right direction because they help folks, young people, with various public service projects. Check it out. We'll post a link for you along with the podcast when it becomes available. All the shows are archived as such. Follow the Amy Beth Arquette Show. You know, BTR, Stitcher, Mixcloud, wherever you get your podcast or ask for it. And also select editions on PopNet and the Arts Radio Network. All roads lead back to our website, amybetharkowi.com. Please reach out to social media. Connect with us. Friend me on Facebook. Follow our producer, Trudy Hart, on Twitter, at Radio Trudy. Follow me for the 24-7 conversation at AB Writes. Thanks to the TCS crew, Trudy and Aurora in the booth, MLA headquarters. Thank you again to Eric Dawson. And come back and see us on the Amy Beth Arkowi Show. Drive safe, play nice, dream big. We'll leave you with a little peace, love, and understanding done up by the Stripes. Energy, boys. I love y'all. Bye.